In Scotland, when friends get together, they blether. When these three friends happen to be Scottish Blue Badge tourist guides, you can be sure that the country that they're so passionate about will be right at the heart of their discussions. Be it contemporary or historical, culinary or cultural, reminiscence or anecdote, from accommodation to zoos, the chat will range right across the entire alphabet of topics and issues that are live and happening in Scotland right now. We hope that you'll join us. There's nothing to beat a richt good blether.
And you could also join in our blethers on social media. You can find us as at Scottish Blethers on both Facebook and Instagram. We post additional content during the week that supports the podcast episode.
We love making the podcast and would love it if you could share them with your friends and leave a review on the platform of your choice.
Hello and welcome to episode 54 of Scottish Blethers. I'm Liz Lister.
And I'm Helen Houston.
And this is a week where we've been getting out and about, Helen, but particularly you, because you've started guiding again.
Oh, yes, Liz, it's been absolutely fantastic. I've had one or two wee jobs, but I've been to Dundee and St Andrews, which was lovely. I had my ice cream in St Andrews, and I've been to Edinburgh, and I went up to the castle, Edinburgh Castle, for the first time for, what will it be, about 18 months. And it was just a joy because it was, you know, there was lots of space. It wasn't overcrowded. It was just lovely. And of course, been to Glasgow, done walking tours of Glasgow. So I just feel that the world is beginning to turn again, and it's looking very positive, not COVID positive.
That's negative. We want that negative. Yes. Well, I'm in awe of you, Helen. I don't know how you do it. I hope it's just like riding a bicycle, that when you fall off, you just get back on and it all comes back to you, because it all seems very scary to me.
But it is, Liz, as you're going to your first job, it is, your head is buzzing. Oh, can I remember this? Can I remember that? But it is like riding a bike. Once you get in, whether it's be the jump seat of the coach or the walking, meeting your people, it's just lovely.
Brilliant. Well, this week in our episode, we're going to be talking about one of our great national treasures in Scotland, the National Museum of Scotland. And I went on a little recce, a little expedition to just remind myself what was there this week, and took the train through to Edinburgh. And who did I meet but our fellow blether, Susan. Met her on the platform. She was out guiding as well. So we are out and about and bumping into people again. So if we kick off then with the National Museum of Scotland. I love it. Do you love it, Helen?
Oh, I do. I do. The trouble is, it's so, so interesting. So many things, Liz, that to do it all, you can't do it all in a day. And we're fortunate that we live within a hop and a skip, that we can just go back and forward and do a little bit each day or each week or each month.
Yeah, I mean, today we're going to be focusing on the Scottish galleries of the National Museum, and we'll explain how it all came into being. But it's interesting that whenever you go into it, even when I'm guiding in it, it's a labyrinth. You know, it's all corridors and curves, and even to get up to the roof terrace on the seventh floor, I always struggle to find my way. So it was really good focusing on it for this week's episode, because I got a lot of things clear in my mind, not least of which is actually the name of it, because even just tracing back the origins, it's quite complicated. I mean, it started really, the origins came starting in 1780, when the Society of Antiquaries of Scotland was formed by the Earl of Buchan, very much in the spirit of the Enlightenment, about, you know, about the fact that we should be gathering Scotland's national treasures together, particularly our archaeological artefacts, medieval objects. So they started that, and later that would go on to form the National Museum of Antiquities of Scotland.
Yeah, but it was quite interesting, Liz, that, you know, even before that, I was looking at the University's Museum of Natural History, which is kind of part of the heritage of the National Museum, and that was formed in 1967, when it was the collections of Robert Sibbald were decided too valuable and appealing to be hidden away, and they were put on permanent display. But then 100 years later, or in fact, even before that, Daniel Defoe had talked about that in Edinburgh and said, "It's a curious and noble museum containing some rarities that are not to be found either in those royal societies at London or the Ashmolean at Oxford." But then over just not much later in the 1700s, Liz, a greater part of it is mere rubbish. No animal preparations can be made with safety in the room. They're overrun with moths and insects, and they are to be thrown out. it's just how tastes changed over that, from something wonderful and hasn't been seen anywhere else to it's just a horrible load of rubbish, let's throw it out.
Yeah, I've got a picture of moth-eaten woolly mammoths in my mind. Yeah, but undoubtedly the University of Edinburgh's collection was pivotal in creating this museum, because at the time, you know, if you think of all these Royal Navy survey ships going off and all these Scottish explorers and Scottish surgeons that are trained in medicine at the University of Edinburgh, over half of the specimens that they brought back came to the University of Edinburgh. So what a fantastic collection it had as a basis for what was to become the Industrial Museum of Scotland in 1854. This was at the height of the Victorian era, and they were very much about the ideals of education and the museum movement. And so that was the start of it. But it was really Prince Albert in 1861 that kicked it all off when he laid the foundation stone.
Yes, I hadn't realised that he was a driving force behind, you know, Britain's museums at that time. He really wanted the museums to be welcoming and open and for people to see what was going on so they could understand their heritage.
Yeah, but he didn't follow his mother's advice. He did not wear his hat when he was laying that foundation stone. And it was a cold, wintry day in Edinburgh. And he already had a cold, but it got worse. He got pneumonia and he died shortly afterwards. So it was always thought that that was part of the reason for his early demise.
So a note to self, to all our listeners, when you're coming to Edinburgh or Scotland, make sure you pack a woolly hat.
No, don't do, because I always think that my tour members add to the Scottish economy, because tour goes on, they buy more and more woolly hats and scarves. So it's always good for the economy.
Yes, it was funny. One of my tour members on my trip to St Andrews, he came off a cruise ship. And the first thing when he came back to the coach after our day in St Andrews, he was carrying quite a number of carrier bags. I said, "Oh, what have you been getting?" He said, "I've been buying some woolly jumpers. I'm really quite cold."
Charity shops are always good for that.
Exactly.
Seek it out. But another thing that I learned when I was looking into this, that he died, but it was actually his son, Prince Alfred, the second son of Albert and Victoria, who opened the museum officially in 1866. And what I didn't know was that he had actually studied at the University of Edinburgh. So again, strong links there. And when it opened, it was known as the Edinburgh Museum of Science and Art, very Victorian.
And of course, I didn't know about Prince Alfred either, Liz, until I read that as well. But it was it wasn't just the museum that transformed the south side of the old town of Edinburgh. There had been a new town there, but most of that was knocked about to get Chambers Street and the museum sort of in place at that time. But I thought that another interesting thing was in the early 1900s, they installed electricity. Mm-hmm. And that allowed them then to get some interactive exhibits in place using the electricity. So, and I think that nowadays, that's what, when you go to the National Museum, so many children, you know, just enjoying what's there, but loving the interaction of some of the displays.
Yeah, I mean, it's very much a venue for school trips. I used to go there. But even before the electricity, Helen, when it was first opened in 1866, it was one of the first, well, first of all, it was the first public building in Scotland, but it was also the first building to have gas lighting. So just imagine if you were one of the residents of Edinburgh and you could actually go at night to visit the museum. I mean, you've got that spooky film, A Night in the Museum. Oh, yes. Just imagine wandering around amongst all these exhibits, because this museum was about the world coming to Scotland. It was your traditional museum, natural history, world cultures, science and technology, and art and design. So a traditional museum.
Yes, I like that, to show the world to Scotland, because at that time people weren't travelling. You nor ordinary people were not travelling the way they do today or will do again today. So just seeing and some of the artefacts that they brought from across the world were just fantastic.
Absolutely. And even the building itself, it must have been so impressive. In time, it would become known as the Royal Museum of Scotland. But when it was built in Victorian times, it was going back to Renaissance style. You know, it was a style Venetian Renaissance, and this huge, magnificent flight of steps going up to the entry hall. Very impractical, but very impressive. And on the front of it, we've got the sculptures of art and science, and also Victoria and Albert, who were absolutely at the heart of it, and all some great scientists of the time. There's roundels of Charles Darwin, Isaac Newton, Michelangelo. So this was all about this new world opening up.
Yeah, and apparently it was inspired by the Crystal Palace in London as well. And I think that must be the big, huge open hall that they created, the big atrium of the, you know, the light and airy hall that was in there and still is.
Yeah, but remember that the Tay Bridge had also been modelled on it, so it was very fine engineering feat. So these pillars of cast iron had to be as narrow as possible, but they also had to be strong enough to hold up this magnificent glass roof. So safety was very much at the forefront. And one of the things that was very interesting in these narrow pillars is that they actually had radiators built to wrap around them, and you can still see some of them today.
Yes, it's amazing. I think the Victorian engineers really thought of everything, didn't they? They didn't just throw up something with the latest material that was available. They really thought things through.
Yeah, the architect was a military man, Captain Francis Fowke. So he was doing everything with military precision. And it took over 30 years for the building to be fully completed.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, we still admire it, although it's undergone a few refurbishments, obviously, since then, as people's idea of how to display artefacts are brought into play. But it still has a lovely kind of, you know, amazing feel when you go in. I think everybody in the Edinburgh and surrounding areas, it is something, it's part of your childhood, part of your growing up, is the visit to the museum.
Yeah, and then, of course, onto the scene came the new kid on the block, the Museum of Scotland.
Yes, which at first glance looks very, very odd and almost out of place. But when you actually look at it and study the outside of it, you can see it's actually not. It's just a very modern take on traditional styling.
Yes, it came into being with an Act of Parliament in 1985, which was to merge a National Museum for Scotland with the traditional Royal Museum. And right from the outset, the idea was that it would be a modern building and that the artefacts within it would be exhibited in a modern way. It would be curated in a modern way. So when they recruited the architects to design this building, they were looking back into Scotland's architecture of the past, traditional vernacular architecture, for their influences on the building.
Yeah, and it really comes to play. But I think they've been very successful insofar as it does, and it does flow both inside its own museum, if you think of it as a museum, the Kingdom of the Scots on its own, but it flows into the Victorian Museum, as we know that Victorian Museum built to show the world to the Scots, and the new Kingdom of the Scots, Museum of Scotland, designed to show Scotland to the world.
That was exactly it. And so at the heart of the collection was the old collection of the Scottish Antiquaries. That was at the base of it. But the architects were Benson and Forsyth. And Benson, one of his famous statements, Gordon Benson, was that the building itself was the oldest exhibit, because when they built it, they used sandstone from Moray on the northeast coast of Scotland that was millions of years old, back to the Carboniferous era. And so, you know, he was making the building part of the museum. And so it's got all the old features, like the central entranceway, the rounded entranceway, is harking back to the idea of a broch. If you remember when Susan talked about brochs, they were Iron Age buildings. And then at the top of it, you've got little slits that are like arrow slots where they would fire the arrows out. And it's castellated at the top, like an old defensive castle.
Yes, and it's because and it's tall and slim, isn't it? Like a fortified tower house. You know, it's just got that tall and slim, and the it's just, I think it's a lovely building.
It is, but not everybody thought it was lovely. A lot of controversy. Prince Charles, he was a patron of the museum, but when he saw the plans for the architecture, you know, his feeling on architecture, modern architecture, he resigned immediately. So not everybody was happy, but I love it. And inside, it's like a great hall with all these little nooks and crannies where the exhibits are displayed.
Yes, but you said earlier, Liz, it's a bit of a rabbit warren because you. But I think that's good because it makes you explore.
It
makes you get you look around. It's not just given to you on a plate. You have to go and explore and turn. Oh, I wonder what's around this corner. And you could find. You might find the maiden, which is the Scottish guillotine, or you might find a beautiful jewel that belonged to Mary Queen of Scots. It's just beautiful and sets you exploring. Not the least of which is to try to find the lift to the top of the tower.
Yeah, I'm sure it was designed to keep the staff busy because even when you know where something is, you can never find it and you always end up asking one of the, what do you call them, the docents or the attendants in the museum. So they're always kept busy by people asking, now, where is this again?
Yes, and they are so knowledgeable in their own right, the stewards. And I always encourage people to keep asking, asking people what it is and a little story about it.
Yeah, well, it was completed in 1998 at a cost of $44.5 million. And now we have this beautiful building at the heart of the combined National Museum of Scotland. And we were going to talk people through it in three of our favourite objects, talking it through because as well as a new design from the old Victorian design, it was also laid out in a different way. So it tells the story of Scotland through different levels, starting down at the lower level, down in the basement, where we have the very beginnings of Scotland.
Yes, it's really just beautiful. And I think when you look at it in the levels and how it's kind of bringing you right up through to modern day, it does make sense. It makes a lot of sense. We've made it sound as if it's a bit of a nightmare to go around, but it makes a lot of sense if you just take it the way it's designed, the way it's intended.
Yeah, so starting down on the lower level, one of the things that I love, you know, they're talking about how you can integrate the display with the artefacts themselves. And one of my absolute highlights within the Scottish Gallery section is the sculptures by Eduardo Palozzi. Now, he was one of our contemporary sculptors. He was born in Leith outside Edinburgh, but he has these magnificent, like, robotic sculptures. And they are used to display the artefacts from early people, so prehistoric people. So we don't know how these people live. We can only interpret in our own way. And so these robotic sculptures, rather than actual people, are used to display the artefacts.
Yeah, and he had a number of sculptures around Edinburgh as well, not just in the museum, but he had some very amazing sculptures like the foot, the great big foot and the hand outside. They were outside the museum. I think they're undercover at the moment because there's a lot of roadworks going on there. But he was an amazing sculptor, very, very distinctive in style, wasn't he? And to be able to use that style to display the prehistoric people just brought that to life for me as when I was looking in the museum.
Yeah, they are fabulous. They're unforgettable. They really are a highlight of the museum, but they form a sort of avenue as you go in. And as you go into it, one of the first displays that you come to is Beginnings, which is 3 billion years of Scotland's geology and natural history. I mean, anybody who's been on any of my tours, I'm always on about how geology forms Scotland, the landscape and the people and whatever. But it all comes down to these floating crusts on the surface of the earth, the tectonic plates that were floating around and moving around the surface of the globe. And we were in different geological eras. And so for my first object, I am going to Lizzie the Lizard. Right. And Lizzie the lizard was found by one of our famous fossil hunters, a man called Stan Wood, Stan the fossil man. And he found it in an old quarry, East Kirkton Quarry in West Lothian, which is just outside Edinburgh, in 1984. And when it was found, it absolutely set the world on fire because it was thought that this was the earliest ever discovered reptile. Now, that was really important because a reptile marks the move of vertebrates onto land. And so it was thought that this was what was called an amniot. Now, for reptiles to be able to move onto land out of the water, they first of all needed to have a waterproof skin, which this reptile appeared to have had, but they also needed to be able to lay eggs with a waterproof membrane, a kind of primitive shell on them. And for many years, it was thought that Lizzie was a lizard of indeterminate sex that had moved onto land. Nowadays, that's been thrown into doubt, and it's thought that it was actually a sort of transition between amphibians, which have soft-shelled eggs and can only lay eggs in water, and reptiles. But the thing about this is it's what's called a transitional fossil. There's only one of its kind. And so that is absolutely remarkable because it helps scientists to be able to clarify the evolution of vertebrates onto land. So Lizzie the lizard is my first artifact and quite an important object.
Yeah, well, I'm staying within the animal kingdom because one of my favourite ones, because again, a bit like Lizzie, it's such a recent discovery. It's called the Crammond lioness. Now, the Crammond lioness is a really quite a remarkably big sculpture. It's about 1.5 metres long and about half a metre high. And it was only found in 1997. I mean, so recently. And this was the ferryman, a local man who used to run the ferry across the River Almond at Crammond, just outside Edinburgh. And he was looking for stones for his garden, you know, and he thought, oh, that's quite a nice stone there. I'll come back and dig that one out and that'll do for the rockery. But fortunately for him and for the world at large, as he was digging it out, he realised it was something a bit more than just a stone. So he called in the experts and it was discovered to be a lioness which probably dated back to the 2nd or 3rd century AD. And they believe, you know, on closer examination, it was a lioness with the, like, depicting a bound male prisoner, they thought, being killed by the lioness. And the head of the prisoner is in the jaws of the lioness. And it is quite a remarkable thing. And they think that possibly it was some sort of decoration for a Roman officer's grave. Again, there used to be a Roman fort at Crammond. The Romans only came to Scotland really very briefly. Agricola landed in the AD 70 and came into Scotland. There were several forts built along and across Scotland. And then the Emperor Antonine built a wall across Scotland. But within very few years, the Romans were going out of Scotland. They needed to reinforce Hadrian's Wall in the north of England. So this lioness had only a very small window of opportunity to come to Scotland. And they believe it is one of the real treasures of the museum. And you'll find that, as we say, in the early people section of the museum on level one.
Yeah, I mean, it always amazes me that you don't tend to think of the Romans as having a navy, but they needed all the supplies and everything for all the army marching all over Scotland. So Crammond was the centre for the navy and the Crammond lioness. Yeah, moving up a level to the Kingdom of the Scots. This is my favourite level, I think, because I always want to bring my tours here at the end of a tour. It pulls everything together from the creation of a borough to the Stuart dynasty. It's a wonderful description of our nation between 1100 to the Act of Union in 1707. And as you walk straight into it, one of the first things that's facing you as you move in is arguably one of the museum's top pieces, and that's the Money Musk Reliquary. Now, if anybody's watched our Iona virtual tour, you'll know about St. Columba, who's probably one of the most famous of all the Celtic saints, the Scottish saints. And it's thought that in the 8th century, the monks on Iona made this little house-shaped reliquary. A reliquary was a a container to keep the precious relics associated with the saints together. And they made it out of wood and metal. And it's a sort of fusion of the Gaelic and the Pictish design, the two peoples coming together. It's made from single pieces of yew wood, Y-E-W-U, which again has got religious significance. It's the everlasting, the longest lasting plant or animal, very long lasting. And then it's been covered with thin silver and bronze plates. The bronze plates would have had red enamel on them, and the silver plates have got lots of carvings of animals all biting and leaping and twisting. They are decorated onto these silver plates. And as you look at it, you can see two little hinged bits at the edge, which were thought to be used to attach a strap to it. So it would literally have been carried around somebody's neck. And the name for the carrier was Durach, which is where the surname Dewar comes from today, which is an interesting little fact that I didn't know, the name Dewar.
I didn't know that, Liz. That's brilliant.
So it was, if you know anything about Iona and St. Columba, you know St. Columba was known as the warrior monk. And so this was considered to be of assistance. It was giving you protection as you went into battle. So it was the battle ensign of the Scottish army. It's even thought that King Robert the Bruce took it with him into Bannockburn when he defeated the English at Bannockburn. But it's now thought that it probably wasn't the original relic. It was just something that's become known as that, the Brechbenach of King Robert the Bruce, the protection of St. Columba. And it came through the Abbot of Arbroath to the Forbes family and then the Grant family. And then finally, it was bought by the National Museum in 1933. And it's one of our greatest relics.
Yes. What always strikes me about it, Liz, is its size. It is so small.
It is.
And if this was to hold the relics of the saints, it's awfully small.
Yeah, something like yourself, Helen. Small but perfectly formed.
Oh, you're such a gem, Liz. Such a gem.
Moving on.
Moving on. Well, I'm going to talk about another relic that you'll find in there called the Darien chest. Now, the Darien scheme was a political stroke, sort of just a business scheme in Scotland. In the late 17th century, the late 1600s, Scotland was in real trouble economically. It was struggling. The economy was small compared to the rest of Europe. It was, they didn't have a lot of exports to offer. And it was in a weak political position as well compared to the rest of the people in Europe. And so the Parliament of Scotland tried to see what they could do to solve this problem, to make our position stronger. And the Bank of Scotland was established in 1695. And the Company of Scotland was chartered with capital. And that was raised by public subscription. So the people of Scotland were contributing to this. They were trying to build something to trade with Africa and the Indies. But the Company of Scotland soon became involved in the Darien scheme, which was an ambitious plan devised by William Paterson, who I think, Liz, he was the founder of the bank, wasn't he?
Yeah, he also founded the Bank of England a year before, so we're taking that one as well.
Yes, yes. And they found a colony in the Isthmus of Panama, and they wanted to establish trade with the Far East. And trying to avoid, by going there, they were trying to avoid having to go round Cape Horn, the treacherous Cape Horn. So the chest that you'll see, which is quite a big, cumbersome thing, was used to store the money and documents associated with the company. But the Darien scheme turned out to be a disastrous venture, not only financially, but also in terms of people. Many people died. They went in ships over to found a colony, only to find that the excessive heat, the humidity, everything was just not what they wanted. And the trinkets they'd taken to trade with the native people there were not the things that they needed. They didn't need woolly scarves and bonnets. They needed something else. But they were friendly, so it wasn't a problem. It was the heat that got to them and the mosquitoes, the insects. But anyway, they decided to abandon ship after being there not even a year. They'd founded, the St. Andrews was the name of the settlement they founded, but they decided to come home. So many people had died, they decided to come home. But word did not reach home of the disaster before the next expedition set out. And again, it came to the same fate. So of the sort of thousands of people that went to 2,500 people went to Panama, only a couple of hundred managed to survive. The result being was that Scotland was bankrupt. It was absolutely bankrupt. All the money that had been raised for this scheme had come to naught. They hadn't gained a penny from it. So they reckon that this was one of the keys factors that made Scotland agree to or sign the Act of Union, the Union of Parliaments with England in 1707. Because they realised the only way to get unimpeded access to the colonies that belonged to England was to join forces with them. But Scotland, as I say, was bankrupt. It had no money left. It had a huge amount of people needing money paid back to them. And so the new Parliament paid Scotland what became known as the equivalent, which was a very precise sum. It was £398,085.10, a very precise sum. And that was to offset future liabilities towards the English national debt. But if you look at the chest itself, it's a very complex locking mechanism. And I've noted that some commentators have suggested that perhaps J.K. Rowling, when she was writing her Harry Potter, because I think there's one of the books there that has a very complicated chest with a locking mechanism. They reckon that perhaps she, somewhere in her subconscious, she had seen this Darien chest in the National Museum and thought, ah, that looks good for Hogwarts. So that was it. So 15 spring bolts that they've got on it. So that was 1695 it was made, Liz, and still looks as good as it was then.
Yep. And of course, 1707, Act of Union, everything was to change. So as we move up a level, we come to the level called Scotland Transformed. So this is focusing on life in Scotland during the 18th and the 19th century. A tremendous time in Scotland, the time of the Enlightenment, particularly down in the area around about Edinburgh, new ideas, new thoughts, new ways of thinking. But of course, up in the Highlands, not so fortunate, also ways of change. And it was a time of political turmoil because you have the new House of Hanover on the throne, but then you also have the House of Stuart trying to reclaim the throne of Scotland and England and the rest of Britain. And so it was a time of dispute. And we have the Jacobites, the exiled House of Stuart, the followers of King James, Jacobus in Latin. And so this floor, Scotland Transformed, shows us the art, the architecture, the changes in science and technology that were going on through these centuries, and particularly the shift from a rural economy, most people living on the land, they were being put off the land, and so they had to move into towns, and it became an urban industrial economy with the invention of steam power, which again, good Scot James Watt, very influential in that. But I think for your object, Helen, you are referring to the Jacobites.
Yes, I'm going back to the Jacobites, Liz, and talking about Bonnie Prince Charlie's Travelling Canteen. Now, as you know, I like...
It sounds like the name for a band.
It does, doesn't it? Yes. I like to take my grandchildren camping, you know, real intense, lying on the ground, and on one occasion, cooking on an open fire, certainly on about a one-ring burner. And we take our cutlery with us. And that is very, very limited, what we take. But Bonnie Prince Charlie, when he travelled, he took his travelling canteen of cutlery, which neatly contained 31 items of dining equipment, including 2 cups, items of cutlery, a cruet set, and a corkscrew cum nutmeg grater.
Never be without your nutmeg grater.
No, well, that's right. I often don't take that, but I do make sure I've got the corkscrew with me when I go camping.
I'm sure.
But he got this for his 21st birthday, and it's about 6.5 centimetres high. It's in silver, and it's embossed with a three-feathered symbol. It was actually quite a politically and controversial thing because they believe that it was made by Oliphants of Edinburgh, a very good manufacturer. It's quite a seditious item, as the inscriptions are treacherous to the Hanoverian house. It bears the Prince of Wales feathers, suggesting that Bonnie Prince Charles Edward, is the rightful heir. And it's got the Scottish Order of the Thistle, which is, again, gifted by the crown. And when he came from Rome, he brought this with him. And it was found abandoned on the battlefield of Culloden, which is really, you know, quite sad to think this beautiful thing, but so good that it was found and has been kept. Apart from a few wee scratches and dunts, it's been found and is safe. But it was in his baggage, which, of course, because of the great rout that was Culloden, he left the field quite hurriedly, leaving a lot of his baggage behind. But as we know, he was still so well liked in the Highlands that he managed to hide for about 3 months in the Highlands without being given away by anybody, despite a huge ransom on his head. So his canteen of cutlery, he didn't have it on his flight through the heather, but he might well have looked for it from time to time.
Yeah, and as you say, a complete rout, the baggage train left behind, and Scotland would never be the same again. The Stuarts defeated for once and for all. So life was to change. We've talked about the Highland clearances up in the Highlands, but down this move to industry. And of course, many Scots not only moved to towns, but moved overseas. They spread across the world, the great Scottish diaspora, leaving their homeland in large numbers. And they became known because they were highly educated and they were adventurous, they were explorers. And so the Scotland began to punch above its weight and was known throughout the world. During the late 18th, right through to the 20th century, it was the height of the British Empire, where in the 1890s, the British Empire spanned a quarter of the world's landmass. It was enormous, trying to imagine just how much was dominated by the British Empire. And Scottish innovation and the products we created were known everywhere across the world. Literary figures, missionaries who travelled the world, bringing the religion to areas like Asia, India, Africa. And at home, we were an industrial nation, and Scotland became known for shipbuilding, for whisky production, and for railway engineering. So the industry and empire reflects this floor in the Scottish galleries, reflects all of this. And this is what I've returned to for my final object here, because it has very personal significance. When you're on that floor, you see all these magnificent creations, the railway engines, the stills that were used to make the whisky production. But at times they also hold special exhibitions. And a little while ago, they held an exhibition of railway posters. Now, the artist that was responsible for this was not Scottish. It was an English artist called Terence Tennyson Cuneo. But he was working in the 1950s onwards. And at the end of the war, he was recruited to design a series of posters and paintings which would illustrate the new fledgling British railways that was being created after the war to modernise the railway system in Britain. Now, he, as a child at 5 years old, had been given a model steam engine, and he had this huge passion for engineering and an eye to see things on a great grand scale. But he also had the skill as an artist to produce a detailed, illustrative style of work. And one of his passions was railway engines. Now, why this has significance to me is because these posters were used by British Rail. And as I've said before, my father worked for British Rail and worked his way through from a junior railway clerk all the way up to senior level. Now, the railways, British Rail, was a very hierarchical organisation. And so as you worked your way up, with each promotion, you got a new symbol of status. So as he began to work his way up, first of all, he got his office, an office of his own. And then the next thing was you got lino on the floor. And then the next thing was you got a rug on top of the lino. And then the next thing was you got a painting. And these paintings that were on the walls were the paintings of Terence Tennyson Cuneo. And the trademark of this artist was a little mouse. Now, it said that when he was painting, he was also the artist who was commissioned for the coronation. And while he was painting one of these coronation paintings, his cat brought a little dead mouse into his studios. And so just as a wee bit of light relief, he painted a little cartoon of a mouse eating a piece of cheese. And when he went to his next exhibition, this was the first painting that sold. So from then on, he would always paint a little mouse into his paintings as a symbol of good fortune, hoping that the picture would sell. And so when I was a little girl, as we moved through the various offices with the various paintings on the wall, I can remember vividly trying to find the little mouse on the paintings. So a nice personal recollection. And as I say, he's not Scottish, but there are various pieces of his work through the galleries of the National Museum of Scotland.
And of course, you mentioned the exhibition, and they have exhibitions, really fascinating exhibitions running from time to time in the National Museum. You know, you've talked about the railway posters. They've had typewriters more recently. They had a lovely exhibition on the Stuarts abroad, you know, when the Stuarts were exiled at the time of the Jacobites. Really very, very well and very well displayed and set out.
Yes, and at the moment, as I was in this week, they also have one on Sir Walter Scott, which has been very close to our heart over the last few weeks. So if you're around in Edinburgh over the next few weeks, you might want to look that up. But at all times, they always have these artefacts. They're just brought together into a special collection for exhibitions.
And I was just going to say, Liz, that if when you are in the museum, try to make sure you're there on the hour and go to the Millennium Clock. It is, we'll not go into detail about it. Just go there. It is a wonderful surprise.
It is. Okay, Helen. Well, we could talk on this as we have done for ages, but let's move on to our word of the week. What's your word of the week?
Well, I was thinking of these artefacts that have been around for so long that they must have experienced a few dunts along the way.
Good word.
And a dunt is like a bash or a hit. And I just love this expression I found that you say, goodness, that was a sair dunt you gee yourself. You know, it means that was a serious blow you hit. You know, when you hit your head or
yeah.
I noticed that somebody had a, you know, the skin had come off their rather balding head. And I thought, gosh, that was a real dunt.
Well, I was trying to think of a good Scottish word associated with a museum, and I thought of traipsing. You know, if you weren't too keen to go and your folks were traipsing you, you were traipsing around you, dragging your feet. I don't think that's really Scottish. So one that is an absolutely true Scottish word, it's used in our family all the time. And it came about yesterday because I had put a photograph up on our family WhatsApp. My neighbour had just got this huge mound of manure delivered for his roses and his vegetable beds. And I took a picture of this and I said, this would be good for the rhubarb. And immediately my brother came back and said, feast. Now, feast is a word that we use a lot in Scots, which just basically means yuck. Ugh. So it's not a rude word. It's got no, it's just a good old Scottish word, feast. And there's an even better word, which is the adjective fee. So that jam's gone all fee.
Yes.
Very descriptive.
That's a really good one. And you can see the facial expression even as you're forming the word.
Okay, well, I think that brings us to an end, Helen. Congratulations to our American cousins that are listening on your absolute slaughter of the European side at the Ryder Cup yesterday. Stayed up late watching that. But congratulations, a wonderful victory by the American team.
Yeah, poor Rory was in tears on the radio today.
Yeah, he redeemed himself. In fact, it was the three old guys that redeemed themselves at the end, having had much criticism. As old guys have always got something to deliver, Helen.
Yes.
Bye for now.
Bye for now, everybody.
And there we have it, the end of another episode of Scottish Blethers. If you'd like to join us on social media, you can find us on Facebook and Instagram as @ScottishBlethers. And if you'd like to leave a review, please do so on your podcast platform of choice. It's cheery bye from me.
Ta-ta the loo from me.
And if I don't see you through the week, I'll see you through the windy from me.
Bye.
See ya.
Bye.